This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Fideous Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news from the past month. This is episode 50 for November 2014. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first episode of the relaunch of the Fideous Club. This show has been off the air for about over 2 years now, and I recently left my job to dedicate myself to podcasting, and I thought one of the shows I really wanted to do was this show and bring it back, and so, well, that's just what I'm doing and what we're doing together. Together with the co-hosts I'm going to introduce in a couple of seconds, but also together with you guys, the listeners, because this show is going to be supported by Patreon, and there's a Patreon that you can go check out. I'm sure there's going to be tons of links everywhere on the web pages and in the metadata of the MP3, but some people have already, before the show even relaunched, they've decided to contribute to the Patreon, which I'm insanely grateful for. So thank you so much. I hope it's going to be worthy of your support, and I hope it's going to be going for a long time now. So with that out of the way, I'm going to introduce the co-hosts and then tell you a little bit about what the show is and what it isn't if you're joining the show for the first time. So co-hosts, we have three wonderful people with us today. The first of which is my partner in tech, not crime, but tech reporting, Tom Merritt, here from the Daily Tech News Show, among other things, on the internet. How's it going, Tom?
It's going well, Patrick. I cannot tell you how pleased I am that the Fideous Club is back. Selfishly, as a listener, I just have missed being able to hear it every time you do it. So I'm very excited to be back, and I'm very honored to be on the first return episode.
Thank you. And you're sort of, you know, my go-to person on anything I do, apparently, for the first episode.
Yeah, so. I can be your lead-off guest. That's fine. I like that.
Very kind of you to be here. Of course, Tom is from the U.S., if you don't remember, West Coast, so he'll bring that perspective to the show.
When last you saw me on Fideous Club, I was in San Francisco, though, so now I'm in Los Angeles. So much different.
So you're going to be corrupted by the superficial reality of the movie city and industry, right?
Yeah, exactly.
We also have, as always, we sort of span the globe in this show, and we also have Eric Olander from Vietnam, of all places. I can't remember if you were already in Vietnam when we last recorded the show.
No, like Tom, I was in a different city. I was in Paris, actually. I was the editor-in-chief of France 24, but fled the French, now in Vietnam. Running a news network out here, and also podcasting and blogging and the like.
Yes, you're still focused on China and Africa?
China and Africa. We just crossed 1 million downloads this week, 250,000 on Facebook. So we're moving ahead, even though I'm in Vietnam, not in China or Africa for that matter.
Well, you're closer to China, I guess. So
exactly.
Yeah, that can help. And so thank you so much, Eric, as well. And we have Paolo, who's another returning guest on the Fideous Club. Paolo is joining us from South Africa. How's it going? It's been also forever.
I can't believe it's been 2 years. Thank you very much for inviting me back on the podcast. I'm excited that it's back and hopefully bigger than ever.
Well, you know, really, it was about the accent. I figured we need to have the South African accent on the show. And obviously, you were the one to do it. So thank you very much, Paolo, as well for being on the show. Before we jump into the stories, a very quick word about what the show is and, as I was saying, what it isn't. So what the show is a comment... roundtable discussion about the world news, current affair topics that happened in the past month or so. And we try to get people from different countries, different cultures, different backgrounds from around the world, and to discuss these topics, mostly the common topics that we've all heard about, with two aims. The first one is that we'll get some different perspectives on what we're discussing. So, you know, I realize that we have a very, maybe not unified, but if you always listen to one kind of reporting, you'll pretty much get the same, maybe not the same, but a unified view on a certain topic. Even if you're listening to different outlets from the same country, you certainly won't get a completely different take on the topic, or not usually. And the other thing is, maybe sometimes we'll hear about things that are completely unknown to us and that are apparently very big deals in other countries around the world. So basically, perspective, different perspectives, different angles on stories we hear, hopefully enriching our knowledge of these events, is the aim of the show. So what it isn't, though, is we're not journalists, or, well, I guess some of us are. Eric is a journalist, and Tom has a journalistic background for sure. But we're not reporting on the news, right? I don't even think we're quite commenting on the news. It's just a bunch of people getting around a table and saying, hey, here's how we perceived and how we discussed the news in our neck of the woods being the world. And of course, we can have some journalistic elements to our discussions, but it's not the primary goal. It's really to think, to say, our news, our media is reporting this news like that, with this angle, with this kind of discussion, and hopefully that makes for an interesting discussion on the show as well. Is that a fair assessment of what the show is supposed to be, as you guys see it?
Well, that's what made it successful in the past, so I don't see any reason why to stop now, right?
Yeah, I think so too.
Yeah, I think you're right. We're not reporting. We're not analyzing in the technical sense.
Right.
But, you know, we're just having a conversation. I like it.
Mm-hmm. All right. So the show has been off for 2 years. So I think maybe anything in the past 2 years is fair game. But certainly there have been really prominent topics that have surfaced pretty much everywhere around the world. And I think one topic which is getting a tiny bit out of the news cycle, at least here in France, but I think warrants discussion because it's close enough to us that it's still significant, but it's also a worldwide concern or discussion. I would like to talk about the Ebola crisis. And I guess I'm gonna start, but I'm wondering if we shouldn't let the American start and let Tom discuss how the Ebola thing.
Well, you got somebody who's actually on the continent in which the crisis is taking place, but you want to go to me first?
I don't know. It seems like, you know, the Americans have been making a much bigger deal. But you're right.
That's interesting. That's interesting, because I actually think that from within the United States that it was way overhyped here, considering the danger. So it's interesting that actually is the perception outside of the United States.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Tom, as well. I was in the States recently I just came back to South Africa. I was in the States for about 5 months doing some work there. And when the story broke, the Ebola story broke in the media, I mean, it was, like you said, kind of blown out of proportion. And when I came home back to South Africa, it was a completely different perspective on it. So,
how was it?
So when I was in the States, I was doing a lot of traveling within the States and watching a lot of local media reporting on the Ebola crisis. And well, that's one of the things the words they use, crisis. And it just became very apparent to me how much they wanted to blow it out of proportion. And maybe that had something to do with there was just not that much else in the media to report about. But everybody was panicked about it. I mean, they were talking about closing schools. I think a couple of schools in Texas closed. And I was like, well, this is a world away from you guys. Like, why are you so concerned? I mean, there is concern to be had, but I think they really blew it out of proportion.
So how was it when you were looking at your, you know, local South African, or maybe even, I don't know if how much of an insight you have into African reporting in general, but you know, you're in Africa, so basically you're our man in Africa, so anything African is your thing.
It was interesting because a lot of people even said to me, aren't you concerned about going to South Africa? Aren't you concerned about the Ebola virus getting you? And I'm like, well, if you think about it, Johannesburg, where I live, is further away from a lot of where the outbreaks were then Paris or London. So it's not really that close to it in any regard. And there's a whole bunch of countries in between us. So wasn't concerned at all. And when I arrived, I mean, it was just one of those articles in the news. It wasn't the breaking crisis that the Americans had portrayed it to be, you know.
It certainly was similar in France, meaning it was reported on for sure, and there was some legitimate amount of concern. There might have been a couple of inflammatory pieces of reporting that were a little bit over the top, but I don't think anyone genuinely ever feared for their for their life. And I'm laughing as I'm saying it. I shouldn't be, but that's the way it felt like. For it here in France, we were being reasonable looking at it, and especially knowing, you know, there's a lot of issues of education, like knowing how Ebola is transmitted puts your fears to rest immediately. Like when you know it's not airborne, you're basically like, all right, so as long as I'm not, you know, kissing someone or, you know, swimming around in their bodily fluids, I should be fine. And it seems like that part of the reporting, it was completely left out of a lot of the American. But yeah, Eric, maybe.
But it was. But again, this was only part about Ebola in the United States. Part of it was, though, that, you know, about the confidence in government to actually do something right. And so when the CDC started coming out and really having to backtrack on the information they were giving. And then we found out that in Texas, after we had been told that the United States was ready to deal with this, everything was ready. We had the best healthcare system in the world to be able to deal with this. This is
well,
not that's, Liberia.
That's your first, you know, that's your well, first
hold on.
Thing.
Yeah. I mean, but this is the narrative in the U.S. And then all of a sudden, you know, things go south in the emergency room in Texas, where they turned away the Liberian gentleman. When he was admitted, he was not dealt with properly. And all of a sudden, confidence in the system started to shake. And you're also dealing with the United States right now at a period in its history where it feels extraordinarily vulnerable. And so it's interesting that the narratives about ISIS conflated with the narratives about Ebola came at the same time as the elections. And so what ended up happening was, you know, Fox News and Republicans and a lot of people kind of rode that wave of fear. And
so you think it's politically motivated?
No, I don't think. I think it's all, you know, this is all a soup. And there's a lot of different things in that soup. But fear is one of the things right now that emerged from the United States when the rest of the world, you know, where, you know, here in Southeast Asia, communicable diseases are a daily threat. It's a real thing here. You have heat, animals, and people next to each other all the time. And yet the panic that came out of the United States was disproportionate to the threat. And a lot of people, I think, as you saw in Europe.
How was the reporting and the, well, I don't want to say crisis anymore, but how was the event handled in Vietnam then?
Vietnam is terrified of Ebola, and but understandably so, because Vietnam is a country that is, you know, at the 50% mark in terms of wealth compared to all of Africa. So half of Africa is wealthier, half of Africa is poorer. So it knows that if Ebola lands here, it can't do anything about it. It doesn't have the resources. But they have a lot of diseases that are on that front. But in developing world countries, they're terrified of something like what's happening in Liberia happening here because they don't have the resources. And at the end of the day, we also know that the international community will not come to its aid the same way that it would for other diseases. I mean, Ebola, the you know, look at what the response has been. It's been quite minimal relative to other diseases.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's only about the ability for the government to tackle the problem. I would also say it's got a lot to do with the environment that the disease it accumulates in. In South Africa, we've got a very large percentage of impoverished people. And it's very unfortunate, but these are the areas, these are the places that the diseases start to thrive in because they don't. The people who are living in these areas don't have access to immediate health care. They don't have access to clean running water, you know. So the majority of Africa lives in this state, and it's very difficult for even countries like South Africa to manage it, even though we have the infrastructure to possibly deal with it. You can't solve the root of the problem, which is these areas that disease, and I'm sure it's the same in Vietnam, where people live and a lot of diseases thrive normally, not to mention major diseases like Ebola.
So I guess I'm curious, was the reporting informative in the sense that, again, it was explaining the way the disease spreads, like saying what you should do if you think you have an unusually high fever or was it, especially in South Africa, I guess you addressed it a little bit earlier, saying you're really far away from the centers of the crisis, but it wasn't really an immediate concern in your media?
No, it didn't. It is a concern, and it is something that I think they made everybody aware of. But we already have a problem with AIDS in South Africa, so people are very aware about disease and keep. I mean, it's part of our education in schools on how to keep. You know, like if somebody's cut themselves, don't assist them unless you have gloves or the proper medical equipment to treat them because you don't want to contract a disease from them. So. It's not
so. It's already part of the culture to be careful.
Yeah, it's already part of our culture. So it wasn't blown nearly out of proportion as it was in the States, but it was made very aware. And it was interesting when I came into South Africa, they have a monitor as you walk in through passport control that is taking your heat temperature, trying to differentiate people who have high temperature, maybe a disease or something, and there's a guy watching it.
And if the temperature is too high, the sirens start ringing. You get a dozen squadrons of SWAT people pointing their guns at you. Right, that's the way it goes. Right, correct.
I don't know what happens when they find somebody.
No, but they've been doing that for over a decade here in Asia after the SARS crisis. That if you have a fever, you don't fly. Which is not an unreasonable thing, considering that you're going to be in an enclosed tube for 10 hours, you know, circulating air. But that's been since SARS, they've been doing that here. So the rest of the world, in some ways, is just catching up with Asia on that front.
Right.
And I think we had introduced it as well a while ago, because I remember seeing the screen at the airport, but I never paid much attention to it until I saw them proactively looking, I suppose, for signs of it in the airport. But I guess in these major hubs where people are traveling in South Africa, they are very proactive in trying to discover anybody, but nothing to blow whistles and alarms off at this stage. I mean, you know, there hasn't been a case in South Africa, so not a big concern at this stage.
So, Tom, is it how realistic is our perception of that's completely super meta? Like, our perception of the Americans' perception of Ebola is they're panicking and, like, you know, being completely unreasonable. Is that just us getting the most extreme examples and going like, oh, those crazy Americans, they're so funny? Or is it really something that happened, you know, as we discussed?
Well, like, it's hard for me to say. I mean, I this is always my difficulty in answering these
because
questions.
Because you only watch BBC.
I read the BBC, I listen to The Economist and Dan Carlin, and those are the main sources of my news, and RSS feeds and this and that. My experience of this was being well aware of the outbreak in Guinea and Sierra Leone and Liberia well before I heard anyone else talking about it. But that's perfectly normal. I read news that I don't hear people in general talking about on the street. And then suddenly all my sources were of U.S. news were starting to talk about it, and friends were starting to talk about it, and it immediately became hyped. And I think it's because in many ways exactly what Eric was talking about. And the one thing I would add is U.S. television news particularly, but news in general, is very much about grabbing viewers, grabbing headlines, grabbing eyeballs. And this is a kind of story that's controversial and is going, people are going to look at and say, oh my gosh, a disease, how do I not get it, right? And a very infectious disease, Ebola, since the 90s has been something that's, you know, very dramatic in its symptoms, etc.
But I guess
the one thing I want to mention is that I had a friend come over, and this was when I first became aware that it was sort of in the general populace's mind. She said, "How about that Ebola?" And I was like, "Yeah, there seems to be a lot of overreacting going on." And Shepard Smith of Fox News, by the way, had just done a 3-minute "You Don't Need to Worry" piece trying to calm people down. And my friend's like, "Yeah, but my wife is a nurse." And they gave her a kind of an Ebola breakdown, you know, like what to look for, et cetera, training. And she's frightened now. And I thought that was really interesting, is that it wasn't coming from the media. The media was sort of giving her the background anxiety, but getting the responsible training, which nurses should get, because it's like, hey, you know what? We're dealing with this in Texas right now. Who knows? We might have to deal with it. So let's be ready. Raised her stress levels, even though she was a trained professional.
Yeah, that's surprising, I guess, is a kind way of putting it.
But Tom, don't you feel like if it wasn't blown up in the media, let's say the media element was removed and she was just given the training, they said, hey, this is happening in the world right now, we feel it's prevalent for you to be aware of it, she would have been as concerned? Or do you think the media has aided in making her paranoid about it?
Right. I mean, it's hard to say, but it seems like she would be less worked, right? Yeah. There's sort of this background level that boosts the anxiety. At least that's my thinking on it. But I do think that it was very telling, and I think it's under mentioned that Fox News was the one who had an anchor coming out saying, "You are not going to get Ebola. You do not need to worry about Ebola. Yeah, stop freaking out."
Yes, but Tom, with all due respect, though, while Shepard Smith did a responsible thing there, Bill O'Reilly in primetime, who has, I think, probably 5 times the audience that Shepard Smith has, was saying exactly
the
opposite.
Was the cause for Shepard Smith to
He was absolutely, yeah, no, he was the one saying, you got to shut the borders down, cut the flights off, you know, and the rest of Fox was going hysterical. So,
okay. You know, was it different on other channels, though? Like CNN doing the responsible thing?
No, they were all doing the same thing.
Okay.
I mean, they were all using the graphics and they were all using the fear music and the whole thing.
So what is it? Did they? Okay, 2 questions before we move on. Let's not spend the whole episode on Ebola. First question, is this a function of the 24-hour news cycle that, you know, they have to be talking about something all the time and basically the commercialization of news? And second question, were they also doing the responsible thing at the same time, saying this is how you catch it, this is what you need to do if you think you have it or if you encounter it, and, you know, doing some maybe more level-headed reporting?
Tom, go ahead.
Either one of you.
Well, yeah. I mean, my limited exposure was just to that Shepard Smith Fox News thing. And so, yes, they were doing both things, as Eric points out. They were both inciting people, but also telling them the things that they needed to do. And yeah, it's entirely about the 24-hour news cycle. What was most telling to me was this was a story months before they picked it up. It only became a story when it looked like it was getting out of control and the WHO was starting to say, hey, I'm not sure we have enough resources to handle this. And then it became, now that's interesting. A runaway outbreak. Let's play to that. And now that it's back under control and it looks like, the outbreak may be spreading to Mali. That's of concern. But even in Guinea, it's starting to come under control. Nigeria never gets enough credit for having fought it off. And that was impressive the way they shut it down.
We don't
hear about it anymore.
The disease spreading aren't because this is some kind of a weird mutant, zombie virus. It's because there are, rights and hygiene practices which are not appropriate in those countries.
Well, and there's places out in the forest where communities don't believe it. They're like, that's a government lie. We're not letting you in here. Yeah.
Well, listen, I mean, on one sense, blaming the 24-hour news cycle would be one thing. But, France has a 24-hour news cycle, and it's got ITELE, and it's got France 24, and it's got a number of 24-hour channels. It's commercial as well. Japan has a 24-hour news cycle. Hong Kong has a 24-hour news cycle. South Africa, in fact, has 24-hour news channels as well. So this idea that it's the 24-hour news cycle that's causing the panic, I don't think is entirely accurate, only because lots of countries have that.
That's very true. I never thought of that.
They're all gunning for money. True. They've got helicopters in the air doing, all the other things, just like the United States. One point of small difference that I disagree with Tom just a little bit here, with all due respect, is that the issue isn't actually under control in West Africa. Americans have gotten bored of the story. So it's not being covered anymore. The fear is gone. That doesn't mean it's under control. It just means that more Africans are dying and that they don't care anymore.
I understand what you're saying. I'm referring to the World Health Organization saying today that they're stable in Guinea.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
As this stops being like, it's spreading more and more and more and more. And that's why I mentioned Mali, because that's an area of concern.
Yeah.
The U.S. gets bored of it. So I'm entirely in agreement with you, which is
there we go. Okay.
No, that's only a fair those point. People but, are dying now. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now it's back
and to be
to
fair,
being
it's
the...
not. Yeah, it's not. It's not a big story in France anymore either, because same thing. It's gotten a little bit boring, and it doesn't concern us directly anymore.
And now we know we're not all going to die of Ebola. So okay, whatever.
It's the same in South Africa. I mean, it used to be quite prevalent in world news, but now it's. I mean, the only thing that's come up recently that's happened in our reporting has really been the theft of the blood in the one transport that happened. Did you guys hear about that?
Didn't
no.
I didn't.
There was. Let me see if I can pull it up here. There was a theft where they stole a couple of vials of blood, I think during a transportation. And crime is always a topic of discussion in South Africa, and this was one thing where they were saying, I'm trying to find out exactly which country it was, but they were transporting samples of the virus in, I think it was Guinea, and they got hijacked and stolen. And
wow.
That came up.
Are you sure this isn't a trailer for the next James Bond?
Well, it was definitely an interesting story, but and the authorities were pleading with the criminals to return the virus, and they can keep whatever else they had taken. They just want the virus back,
Wow.
But I don't
the
think
gun, leave the virus.
Yeah. I don't think they actually knew what they were taking. And I think it was just probably a common theft, because what they were saying was that the transport used was just a regular taxi. And in the theft, it highlighted one of the issues with how these organizations are dealing with the virus. They're using a regular taxi to transport highly contagious materials in an area that's already got issues. And
So that would make it completely unbelievable as a James Bond movie. No one would believe that the organization would use a taxi.
I'm looking at it. A Red Cross courier among 9 passengers sharing a taxi.
Wow.
Yeah.
The samples.
All right. Let's not spend too much time on Ebola because we have other things to cover as well. Unless someone wants to say something more. I sort of cut you off, Paolo, here.
No, that's fine.
Okay. All right. I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk about that again in future episodes. But for now, I want to talk about something that surprised, I think, a lot of people. And that's the fact that in the two years the show has been off the air, apparently we turned our clocks and calendars back to the Cold War era because Russia has become the big villain again. And obviously, that has been a huge amount of that has been a huge topic of discussion. In France, maybe again, not in the super recent weeks, but certainly over the past few months. There's obviously the issue in Crimea has made headlines, but even more than that, the fact that Putin has become very adversarial towards the West, and the fact that Russia is becoming a... Well, I'm joking with the Cold War thing, but it's not completely inaccurate. There is a feeling that it might, if the situation keeps going like that, we might find ourselves in a world structure with Russia and a few of its allies being against the entirety of the Western world. So, all right, who wants to go first? Maybe I would be curious how that relates to, China and maybe Asia in general. So I'm going to give the talking stick to Eric.
Well, it's very related to China. I don't agree with this whole narrative that we're hearing about going back to the Cold War. And it's something a very simple, convenient, it feels familiar and comfortable for journalists and the public to kind of, you know, warm up to a fire and feel good about, because that was a war that we understood and that we felt good. And it was one that we won, too. So that's a narrative that we also like. Unfortunately, it's a lot messier and much more complicated than that. I think what it reflects is the multipolarization of geopolitics. That is, we're seeing the end of the American era of global hegemony. We're seeing the end of the era of American supremacy. America will still continue to be a superpower, but it will be one among many different poles around the world. So what was interesting earlier this year to kind of think about how this is manifesting itself is that within 1 week, the same week, two Chinese J-21 fighter aircraft went up to an American surveillance plane and showed their belly, which is a very aggressive maneuver to show that you have armed weapons on the belly of your plane. And then they pulled away. In that same week, Russian fighter jets did something very similar in the Ukrainian area where NATO jets were flying around. And so what we're seeing is that the Chinese and the Russians are... They have aligned interests. Now, remember, these two are not allies by any stretch of the imagination. They have old grievances with one another, and there's a lot of distrust. But don't forget that Vladimir Putin signed a $400 billion gas deal with the Chinese. So he's insulated in many ways from a lot of the pressure that's coming from the West. However, what he's not insulated from financially, yes,
yeah.
At least from the Chinese, who will suck up as much of his natural resources as they can sell. That being said, he didn't bank on oil being at $75 a barrel, and that's really going to be a big challenge for him. But the Chinese and the Russians are pushing the system away from an American-led system as fast as they can. They want to change the rules of the game. They don't believe that the rules of the game are in their interest right now. And China, certainly, as the emerging economic superpower of the world, becoming the number one economy next year or the year after, depending on what statistics you look at, wants to change everything about the system. And the Russians are going to take advantage of that.
So how is it looked at in Vietnam? Or, you know, if you have a view of Asia in general, I realize how silly.
Oh, no. I mean, this is right in the middle of it. I mean, Vietnam is a country that, you know, gets most of its weapons from the Russians, but at the same time is confronted with, you know, real tensions with the Chinese in the past year. The Chinese, you know, I've been trying to push into the South China Sea and to really push the Americans out of the South China Sea area. And the territorial disputes here are real. And this is something that most Americans and even Europeans are not focusing on. That World War III will probably start in Asia, if it starts at all. But Asia is where
you've got, you know,
the Japanese. Well, no, but it's real. I mean, what you think about the Senkaku-Diaoyu Islands dispute, you've got the three largest economies in the world with as much military hardware all within eye distance of each other. And it is very, very real that they all have three fighter jets up at the air at the same time, almost 24 hours a day. They have drones underneath the waters going after each other almost 24 hours a day.
So
this is a very real kind of tensions that are here. And
that's what's on the news. Like, it's, hey, guys,
it's
like
all that's on the news that's out here. I mean, this is the most sensitive issue out here, the territorial disputes. Now, at the same time, you know, the United States and Vietnam are getting very, very close to each other. The Vietnamese are buying subs from the Russians. Everybody, the Vietnamese, are cozying up with the Indians against the Chinese. But at the same time, the Chinese are developing their relationships in other ways. They've launched the Asian Infrastructure Bank to displace the Asian Development Bank and U.S. and Japanese power in this part of the world. So many different pieces of the puzzle are being moved right now. And Putin is taking advantage of that we're in a very unstable phase of global history. And the United States is impotent in Ukraine. The United States is impotent in so many parts of in the South China Sea to do things. It can't go into these places. It's not going to launch a shooting war over Ukraine with Russia. And everybody knows that.
Go ahead, Paolo.
Well, I don't think the United States is willing to get into a war with anybody at this stage. I mean, the stuff that's happened in the Middle East has kind of, you know, left them a bit bumped and bruised. And it seems as though the Ukraine is this topic of discussion is how much is everybody willing to get involved? How much is everybody willing to put on the line for, is it an internal struggle or is it a struggle that the Russians are just trying to take an advantage of?
So how is it, do you hear a lot about it in South Africa? Meaning it seems like it's quite literally almost half a world away. So is it even a concern or?
Well, it's not really a concern because, like you said, it's half a world away. But I guess the concerning factor is how much is everybody willing to get involved and who's going to get involved? Mm-hmm. But
well, we know the answer to that, which is not much.
Yeah, I guess now we know.
This has been how long has the Ukraine crisis gone on and what's happened? The West and the international community have said a lot, spoken a lot, how outrageous it is, but what have they really done?
Yeah.
Right. And that's all we hear on this side of the world is really, this is what's going on, these are the atrocities that are happening, and here are tidbits. But it's not really much more than, let's say, the Ebola virus that's being spoken about. I mean, it is it's a world topic, but it's not, and we've had a lot of local news that's kind of blown up recently, so it's really taken a sideline in terms of what's been going on.
It's interesting that you make the comparison to the Ebola crisis and that they get about the same amount of play. That's not something I would have expected.
But Patrick, one very quick point to bring up, and then I'll kind of step back on this, is that Russia and China together have effectively neutered the UN Security Council as a venue to do anything anymore. So that there's no more ability to be able to get any consensus on the UN Security Council. So the United Nations as a body to handle a lot of these disputes is now on the sidelines, whether it's Syria, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's even things like Ebola. The UN Security Council used to play a much more prominent role before the Chinese and the Russians were ascendant in many ways, and now that body is gone. It's been taken out as a player, and that's again another example of how diminishing U.S. power is fueling in this in many ways. Because, you know, during the Cold War, the United States was able to really push these international bodies to do what it wanted to do, and now that's not the case anymore.
I guess. From looking at it from France, it's also so my wife is Finnish, and obviously, well, not obviously, I didn't know that before I married her.
Didn't know she was Finnish?
I knew she was Finnish. I didn't know how incredibly I don't want to say afraid, but important Russia was to Finland, because I didn't really know Finland all that much. I'm checking that she's not right here listening to me, so she can't, you know. yeah. Anyway, so but yeah, the so I'm getting a lot of different opinions and analysis on this. From France, it's kind of like looking at it cautiously and kind of not really throwing our hands up in the air. But as you were saying, Eric, it's not like the UN can do much. It's not like the EU can do a lot. And at the same time, it's the if we don't, there's, if we don't let Putin have this, if we take a strong stand, and I don't know how much of this is actually relayed everywhere, but looking at the situation in Russia, it's not easy to see what alternative to Putin there is. Partially because he's silencing all of the opposition, but the oligarchy is still very much in play in Russia. So just thinking, well, Putin is crazy, we have to, you know, get rid of him. And that, by the way, that wasn't a view that I think anyone had until a few years ago. On his first presidency, he was a lot more, he seemed a lot more reasonable. But now there's this idea that he can't, you know, he's veering towards a little bit more of a old Russia kind of attitude. But we don't think there's anything we can do if we replace him.
You French people are as hypocritical as the Americans are, because on the one hand, you will sit there and say how awful it is that he's violating human rights and that he's invading other countries. But at the same time, would you please buy our warships?
Sure.
We have a jobs program. Oh, at the same time, really need your low-cost gas
We
bought locked into long-term contracts. And so they don't really mean it in Western Europe.
No, of course.
Or particularly in France. And so that's, to me, a little bit of the duplicity of all of the kind of shock, horror coming out of Western Europe, which is they can't do anything because your apartment tonight is being heated by Russian natural gas. Painful reality that we're dealing with, or maybe Tunisian natural gas, but still, nonetheless.
Yeah, a little bit less in France. I think we have a little bit less of that, you know, reliance on foreign energy in France, where it's still important, yes, but not as much in other as in other European countries, mostly because we have...
If Germany had to pay, you know, huge amounts of natural gas, that would have a direct effect on France.
Of course. But the other side of the thing that I get from my Finnish half is the concern that you shouldn't poke the Russian bear too much. And there's another thing which my wife keeps telling me, which I'm not sure I understand quite yet, which is the West really does not understand Russia. Mm. And that's a failing for the managing this crisis, and it's a real impediment to actually trying to find a solution, because Russia is a country that is very old, that has a very important, you know, history and culture, and that seems trivial to say, but there's a lot of there's a lot of misunderstanding. We're looking at Russia and thinking, well, we wouldn't do that, or we wouldn't take it that way, or we wouldn't. But it's really not a productive way of looking at it, because within Russia, there are reasons, there are dynamics, there are there is pride, there is all of this coalescing together. That makes, and of course, a lot of other issues. I mean, for sure, Putin isn't a saint, but he is getting some support when we, looking at it from here, would probably not be supporting someone like that. So there's that as well, which is very personal. And I think also fueled by the fact that Finland is a lot more afraid of Russia than the rest of Western Europe. So
I studied Russian language for 3 years in college.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
And the one thing that you just said that struck a memory from me is this narrative in Russian history and from many of the Russians that I talked to about Russia having a bit of an inferiority complex / superiority complex with Europe, where throughout its history, it was constantly wanting to be seen as important in Europe, but then at the same time, wanting to be seen as more important than Europe. Like, we are our own thing. We don't need Europe to be important. We are Russia. But at the same time, feeling like, but we should also be considered just as important as France or England. Mm. And the sort of fascination with French culture, especially in the Tsarist era of Russia. And I think that's why you see a lot of this hankering in Russia for the old days. And Vladimir Putin is a consummate politician. He plays to that. He's like trying to call up the good things from the era in which the Soviet Union was at least felt like it was riding high and the most important power in the world, and saying we are returning to that. You know, we are a strong Russia. Hmm. And I think that's one of the misunderstandings, at least in the media. I don't know how much of a misunderstanding the government actually has on this, but in the media, that narrative is lost.
So talking about the media, how much of CNN and Fox News reporting are, you know, Cold War is back, the devil Putin is coming to take your children, and that kind of thing?
I don't know, but that seems to be what I hear. I mean, from my perspective, the most interesting reporting or commentary, it's not really reporting that I've heard on this, was from Dan Carlin's Common Sense. And he was talking about how that is the narrative that he keeps hearing in media, which is Cold War. And he said, this isn't Cold War. This is World War One. We have a lot of powers, not two powers. And we have a lot of interlocking alliances. And to me, and this is not what Carlin said, but to me, China and Russia feel a lot like England and France. Two historical enemies, well, and maybe enemies is too harsh a word for Russia and China, but not necessarily friends, who are sort of being moved into an alliance of convenience in some ways against, you know, an older power, Europe, that was, you know, broken for a while during World War II, like Germany, but is now reunified and getting stronger. The parallels break down here and there. It's not a perfect analogy, but it's definitely more of this complex situation like we had before World War One than the very clear Cold War. It's the U.S. versus the Soviet Union.
It's funny. Right. There's a lot of that in another way in France as well, in the sense that a lot of people are thinking, well, it will never escalate that far, which obviously is very, you know, reminiscent of World War One.
Right. It's in no one's interest to have a war. Heard a lot before World War One, and you're starting to hear that now too.
Yeah. All right.
But sorry.
Patrick. Oh, go ahead, Paolo.
I'd have to agree with what you were saying earlier, Patrick, where you were talking about.
Oh, thank you. Please keep speaking.
I don't think the West really does understand how the regular Russian feels about what's happening in the Ukraine. Because us as, take, for example, South Africa, we have a country within us called Lesotho. And I was talking about this with my friends earlier today about how would we feel about taking over Lesotho? It's a small country within us, and I don't know if people would, and obviously it's a very different analogy, but the how would the people of South Africa react to taking over a small country that people don't really want to get into a war about? And the feeling I met was very indifferent. I mean, people would be like, a lot of the people I talked to said, yeah, I mean, it would be great because then it would be part of South Africa. You know, we'd be able to build infrastructure, take care of the country, because it's in a bit of an unfortunate situation, that country. And I don't know if that translates to Russia. Do the people generally think, it's fine, like it's just something that should be part of Russia again? Or are they trying to, like Tom's saying, build back the old Russia, the way it was before, take back all the old countries that were part of the Soviet Union.
Yeah. Well, there's a little bit of pride for sure that plays into it. And there's certainly people from within the now annexed old Ukraine that felt, well, we're Russians, we want to be Russians again. So,
yeah, there's a predominant Russian population, and some people point out that that's a lot of the reason for that is because of Stalin. But in the in the eastern part of Ukraine, it's heavily Russian, and Crimea was part of Russia until Khrushchev gave it to Ukraine. And it was also part of Turkey. In fact, there was some interesting articles that came out when they first annexed Crimea that said that an old treaty between, I think, the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire allowed Turkey to go take it back now that Russia had taken it from Ukraine somehow. Thankfully, that didn't happen.
Yeah. It's another thing I guess we can mention as we're moving to another topic is the fact that in France it did spark a few other debates about sovereignty and in the case of, you know, the Basque, I don't know how you say it in English, Pays Basque in French is Basque country.
Basque.
The Basques, who would have a similar claim. Basically, they're saying, well, we want to be independent. Who are you to tell us we can't be? In the same way that, you know, when you say, well, there are, you know, the people of a certain part of Crimea want to be Russians, there should be a certain amount of autodetermination in there. And so when you look at this and apply it to the Basques, they're like, we don't want to be in this stupid French country. Let's just have a vote. And if we want to be independent, then you have to let us go. Obviously, it's never going to happen, or it would be very surprising. But yeah, that came up as well. Talking about nations and sovereignty and moving from country to country, that link is tenuous at best. I think the last and most current topic I want to tackle is the issue of nationals leaving their own country to go and join the jihad in the Middle East. And that has been a very hot topic. Well, I guess I shouldn't say a very hot topic. It's been discussed quite a bit in France and in French media, but maybe surprisingly not as in a super inflammatory way. It's been met with... So if you don't know what we're talking about, there are a lot of people, not a lot, but dozens of people, maybe even more, leaving France and other countries as well to go fight the Islamist extremist jihad in Syria and other Middle Eastern countries. And that is something that for some reason the country is waking up to now. It's been going on for, you know, increasingly in the past few years. It's always happened, but now it's become a topic of concern, maybe because of the renewed media exposure of ISIS and such groups, because of their very public and graphical actions. And the most... not the most surprising, but France has a very large Maghreb, like Northern African population, because of what happened after World War II and the links with colonial empires, and the fact that we got a lot of people from those countries to help rebuild the country, actually after World War II. And so it wouldn't surprise a lot of people, maybe not correctly, but it wouldn't surprise a lot of French people to hear that some of these kids now that are second or third generation Arabs are for cultural reasons, a few of them get enrolled in extremist groups and move to the Middle East to fight the jihad. Not that it's, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be a racist way of viewing things, but it wouldn't surprise people because of the cultural heritage. They would be more subject to these kinds of things. What is surprising, I think, to a lot of people is to learn that there are French... of course, these kids, these North African kids are French as well, but French, how do you say it? Like French parents, French generational French people that have been French for a long time, that are, to put things bluntly, you know, white, suburban, or, you know, middle class kids, or not necessarily middle class, but kids who actually go and fight the jihad as well and go get enrolled and that have completely French, old French names and that you would never suspect could be subject to that kind of enrollment. And that's something that we're learning now when seeing pictures, you know, from these videos and realizing, you know, the media and the police are finding these kids who had disappeared, and seeing kids being stopped at the border. They take a plane ticket to again, Syria or other countries, and they're being stopped at the border. Sometimes they go through and we see them and they're like Maxime something, or that is even more surprising than everything else, I think, for the French. And again, it's not being covered in an inflammatory way, but certainly it's surprising to a lot of people. And we are wondering what we can do about it, why it's happening, because there's a lot of disbelief and lack of understanding. Like, how could this happen? And what can we do to fix it? So that's been a topic of discussion in the past couple of weeks, I would say.
Patrick, I think this has been much more prevalent in the media, where people have come from and gone and joined these organizations. So France is obviously one, and the United States is definitely one, where an individual might go and join one of these organizations, and then the media takes it and runs with it because it's so topical to the country. But in South Africa, that hasn't happened at all, and it really hasn't been a part of our reporting at all. It's funny because coming from when I was in the States, I mean, it was obviously a hot button topic, like you said, but coming here, it was a non-issue. And I thought that was really interesting. And it's because it hits home with people who are in their country, right? You're from France, you know what it's like to be in France, and then you see someone leaving that place to go join one of these organizations. So it kind of hits home for you. You know, whereas somebody who's like, I don't think there's any South Africans from that I know of that have joined these organizations, even though we have a decent size Muslim population. I don't think anybody has gone there from South Africa, and maybe
It's fair to say often the Muslim organizations and these extremist organizations don't have a lot in common. They don't have a lot to do with one another, right? Before we go to Tom for the American perspective, I'm curious about Vietnam.
There's really no connection to Vietnam whatsoever. And in Vietnam, this is not an issue that they follow very closely. China is a very different story, though. There are Chinese who are participating in ISIS and who are doing the same thing as the French. And I think a lot
from
of people
China.
Forget. Well, wow. See, again, that's... you have that surprise. But think about that. 50% of all Iraqi oil goes to China. Think about the fact that the Chinese are very, very tough on Muslims in Xinjiang province. Both Al-Qaeda and ISIS have identified China as same level of enemy as the United States because of the heavy oppression and crackdown on Muslims in Western China. And the Chinese interest in the Middle East and in the Gulf zone particularly and in the ISIS areas is very, very pronounced. Chinese special forces have been deployed there. Again, China has an oil footprint now that is as large as the United States. In fact, I think even larger than the United States now in the Middle East. So China is a very important player in all of this, unbeknownst to most in the West, who, again, one of the problems I think you're reflecting in many ways is this kind of lack of self-reflection that we have in the United States and in Europe. of being able to look at our own cultures and see shortcomings in the cultures that are driving so many youth. So you say, well, how could these young Frenchmen, you know, abandon their suburban white, you know, lower middle class life? Well, in a society that has 25 to 35% youth unemployment and really no prospects for youth employment, where you know you're not going to be richer than your parents, where you know your professional and career and academic opportunities are really very, very limited, where the banlieue in Paris is filled with nothing but hopelessness because they can't get jobs. And then yet the French media and the French narrative is, well, you know, quelle horreur. How could they possibly want to give all this up and go to, you know, go to fight? And at the same time, taking into account that ISIS has been so good, I mean, awesome in their marketing, in their social media techniques. It is, really, they have evolved marketing to a new level in that way. You see the production quality on their videos. And I don't say this out of necessarily flattery. I say it out of admiration in their ability to convey and to recruit. And in some ways, in my last point on this, for, you know, for the tech journalists here who, you know, I've got two who are incredible. This is a classic question of order and chaos. And order hates chaos. And ISIS is chaos. You know, ISIS is what Linux is to IBM or Microsoft. Really, it is. And they can't fight it because there is nothing you can do. Yeah. It's an amorphous.
Different consequences, but same disruption. I get what you're saying.
But it is, it's very disruptive. And yet the established kind of dominant players in the industry cannot do, they can do anything they want, but they can't kill it because ISIS at the end of the day is really an idea as much as anything else. And I don't, again, I'm not saying that in support of them, but it's very hard to kill an idea.
For sure. And I think it's super important to understand this, what it is as a whole period. Tom, the American perspective on this.
Yeah, I was joking before that, you know, we invented this story back in the 90s because even during the Clinton administration, there was a lot of talk about terrorism and Islamic terrorists. And there were stories being done about American boys, always boys, going over and joining them and being brainwashed. And that's kind of
by
been,
the way. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of girls doing it as well, by the way. Just wanted to mention this because it's true. The image we have is boys going to fight, but there are a significant amount of women also.
Yeah, because that's always the way the story is told. It doesn't seem like the narrative on this has really changed. It's always been a certain amount of how could we have let these Americans get brainwashed into doing this, although it's often started to be mixed with these foreigners who didn't appreciate becoming Americans and turning against us. That's thrown in there sometimes as a sort of an overtone. It's not necessarily always explicitly said that way, but it's always a failure of the person or the system. It's never the responsibility. And when I say the system, actually, I should say it's a failure of some other operation. Like, well, we shouldn't have allowed these websites to exist is the current one, right? That brainwash people. But it's never the fact of the economic indicators or the way, you know, the society that people were brought up or the opportunities they were presented with. It's usually,
and there's that lack of self-reflection. That's right.
Yeah. It's usually done as sort of like these other people were allowed to spread their message and trick our boys into joining.
I have to say, it's when I hear you say it, my first reaction is like, those American media, how could they, you know, distort the truth like that? Or how convenient that they're not mentioning this or that, or then that they're not looking at the situation the way it really is. When, of course, when I think about it for another 2 seconds, we're doing exactly the same thing in France. We're not talking about the disenfranchisation of these kids, or at least not prominently enough. Because I think this is a problem. The real problem is one that's almost impossible to solve, or at least not easy to solve at all. Intellectually, you have to dive into very complex discussions if you want to try and solve poverty in the suburbs. But if you say, well, this website said, come and fight the jihad, let's close down this website. And that's an easy concept to grab, right? So it's a lot, yeah, it's a lot easier.
And Americans, what's interesting about the U.S. is that there's no discussion whatsoever that ISIS in many ways is a product, is a creation of the United States. That is, that the a lot of the senior officials inside of ISIS are disaffected Iraqi military who were disenfranchised through the occupation. And the bumbling of the American occupation of Iraq led in some ways, not entirely, but part of it, to what has become ISIS today in terms of the financing methods, the people who are staffing it, and the disaffected military that's there, particularly the Sunni areas.
Yeah. I think, there's certainly affiliation there, but do you think it should be, it's a direct consequence? I mean, if it wasn't ISIS, wouldn't it be another group?
I guess the real question we have to ask is that if the war had not happened, would ISIS be there today? Now, we will never know. It's a hypothetical. And ISIS, I think, is a creation of a lot of different things. And so it's not fair to put all of the blame on the United States. It certainly is not. But in many, I mean, Assad is part of it. In Syria, we even see the harshness of the Shiites in Baghdad as well. Maliki didn't, is very much a part of the father of this as well. So there's a lot of fathers. There's definitely a lot of fathers. But the United States, I would say, bears some responsibility for all this, given their mishandling of the Iraq occupation.
Yeah. All right. I think that's going to do it for our international stories, international topics. How about we cover a few? Honestly, I don't really have one huge local story I think is worth mentioning. We usually in this show go with a few international stories, and then each one of us tries to bring in a local story, and then maybe a weird, silly story as well to finish the show with a little bit of a smile. But local story-wise, there would be the return of ex-president Nicolas Sarkozy, who is saying that he's going to revert the Equal Marriage Act, what is effectively the Equal Marriage Act, which he can't do. So there's a lot of pandering there, which, yeah. And the fact that our president is now almost officially with his girlfriend, the one that he was caught going to on a scooter a few months ago. I'm sure that made, international news because it was probably worth it, I would say, laugh-wise. So there's a couple of things there, but nothing that warrants huge discussions, unless, you guys think they do. But do you guys have any local stories of interest you want to discuss before we move on to our fun kicker stories?
Well, it's not a huge one, but here in Los Angeles, I think I like to try to make my local story not just be the U.S., but where I'm actually living. And way undercover has been a 9-day trucker strike, both in the Los Angeles and Long Beach ports.
Wait, strike? Isn't that the privilege of the French?
I know. I thought you would appreciate this, Patrick.
thank you for thinking of us.
Yeah, sure. Pacer International and Harbor Rail Transport essentially shut down the ports. This is a huge port in Los Angeles. They began on November 13th. They just settled it yesterday. I don't have much to say. I haven't dug into the story, but it's something I've been kind of keeping an eye on because if it had continued to go on, it would start to have actual effects on people's lives that were noticeable, especially during the holiday season. And it really just was ignored as a story.
It's funny. I think there's a lot of preconception that the U.S. doesn't have unions and doesn't have strikes. I think in Japan as well, there's a lot of people think, well, they never strike. They never, when they go on strike, they put this little armband that signifies we're on strike, and that's so silly. I'm talking about the perspective from France because, as we pointed out, striking is a daily sport here. But in the U.S., the unions are strong, and they do go on strike from time to time. But the unions are, at least that's the way I see it, they're a partner that you have conversations with before the lines of communication break down and you have to go on strike, rarely to express your discontent. Whereas in France, it's been getting better, but strike is very often not the first recourse, but one of the first recourse, like you go on strike, you pull the trigger on the strike a lot more easily than you do in the U.S., but it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen or that there aren't unions in the U.S., right?
Yeah, right, and it was really interesting was that the dock workers union did not go on strike, but refused, basically turned away trucks from the two companies that the truckers were striking against.
Funny. All right. So unless there's another...
Well, let me just give one very... The big story that everybody's following over here, and I'm not sure if you've heard about it, is David Beckham came to Vietnam to promote a whiskey. Okay. That was not unusual that he goes around the world kind of promoting some of his endorsements. But while he was here, he took a picture from his motorcade of a woman who was taking a picture of him on her cell phone. It just so happens that she was riding a motorbike, which in Vietnam, that's all we do here. Everybody rides motorbikes, with no helmet, and she had a baby between her legs, kind of standing, also with no helmet. And she's riding one hand, taking a picture. Now, what's funny is that he posted that up on his Facebook page. It got 700,000 likes. And I guess what everybody here is just laughing about is because, well, very, you know, in Saigon, everybody wears a helmet, but helmet is a very loose word of what they do it. In Hanoi, people less so. But children are not actually required by law to wear helmets here. And so it's very common that people are texting, riding, and having kids on their motorbikes at the same time. But yet this time, the rest of the world actually saw it through David Beckham's Facebook page. And shock and horror, after 700,000 likes on Facebook, the poor woman who snapped the picture now is being prosecuted for traffic penalties, breaking traffic laws. So
wow.
There you go. All because of David Beckham.
So did it become like a real concern? Is there going to be different legislation going to be studied or no? Okay,
no,
it's just
no.
Okay. All right.
Just a little bit of embarrassment to the outside world.
Well, thank God for David Beckham.
There's been obviously a lot of hot button topics that have come out of South Africa recently. Obviously, the Oscar Pistorius case. There's the miner strike case. And Shirin Devani, which is another murder that's happened in South Africa. These have all been very hot-button topics. But one of the big ones in South Africa at the moment is, and it's been an ongoing thing, where the president, Jacob Zuma, had used government funds to improve his house to do renovations, and he spent about $20 million US dollars to do the renovations. And it's obviously at the taxpayer's expense. It was for upgrades that weren't security related, and there's been a lot of discussions in the news, and even in our parliament has been up in arms at the moment because the majority party is in support of him, and a lot of people feel that they're trying to cover up what's happened, and the rest of the parties that are in parliament are up in arms. I mean, they brought in the riot police at one of the when everyone was talking about the topic in parliament the other day. It's been
wait,
quite
wait,
a hard
the riot thing. Police in the parliament?
Yeah, they brought in the riot police because all of the individual parties kind of rallied together because the ANC in South Africa has majority rule in parliament. They are, I think, 60-something percent. And the rest of the parties feel that the ANC is covering up this issue and just trying to sideline it. And every party went up and spoke very, very... dramatically, enthusiastically. I mean, we were all watching it on TV. It was quite entertaining, but serious at the same time because of some of the things people were saying. And everybody's kind of standing up against it. But it's just a question of where it's going to go at this stage. Because what they were talking about in Parliament at that stage was another report that was put out to discredit the original report that we have a public protector put out. So yeah, that's one of the big hot button topics at the moment here in South Africa.
So corruption is still a very real issue. I guess it is everywhere. It's kind of disingenuous to say because but
the biggest thing is that it's so blatant, and the people. I mean, politics in South Africa is a very interesting thing, as it is in every country. But the how apparent the corruption has been with the one leading party at the moment is really starting to sway a lot of voters. And we've seen a lot of interesting candidates come out of that. So, yeah, it's going to be an interesting few years. And this has really helped, I think, in terms of persuading voters to look at other options.
When are the elections?
The elections recently just happened. So they happened. And they voted still in favor of the majority party, but it was a lot less than it's ever been. It's the lowest that they've ever had. And a lot more seats in parliament have been given to other parties, which is great. It's great to have that diversity. But there's still one majority. So, yeah, very interesting at the moment in South Africa.
Okay. Thank you for that riveting report. And I think we're going to conclude the show with the one story I really wanted to talk about, unless you guys have, you know, fun city stories as well. I will tell you about the tale of the French suburbs tiger. There, a week ago, there was a report of a tiger roaming the countryside in France. And of course, it was completely it was unbelievable, because where would the tiger come from? It was close to Euro Disneyland. And so a lot of people, you know, started making jokes that it was probably Tigger from, you know, Disneyland that had escaped. And we were hoping that it wouldn't tickle people too much and things like that. That was funny. But it was actually a big story for a few days. And apparently we found out after, I don't know. So they called in the military. They called in specialists from, I think, Finland, actually, because they are used to tracking bears. And they thought, you know, what the hell do we know about tigers? We'll get someone who knows about wild animals, at least.
Why don't they go to somewhere where there are tigers?
Yeah, I don't know. I had no idea.
Okay, and never mind. Just curious.
I don't know. And the kicker is, apparently, it was just a cat. We found out that it was just, I can't remember which kind of, you know, cat. It wasn't like a big cat. It wasn't a house cat, but it was a lynx that, or something similar to a lynx, that was just escaped from somewhere. I said a lynx. It was a fox.
What did it say?
It was yeah, exactly. And it was a fox. And apparently the very surprising thing was, apparently someone had taken a picture of it, and that's why people started believing that it was a tiger. But like, how could you?
So the military was brought to attention for a fox that was roaming in the...
Exactly. And we flew in some experts from Finland to get the freaking fox. So, yeah, there you go. French efficiency at its best. So we haven't heard yet if the fox was on strike for something.
So we had a similar thing happen in South Africa a couple of years ago.
Except it was a real tiger who ate people.
It was a real tiger. And his name was Panjo, if I remember, and he got loose. It was someone's pet tiger. You shouldn't have pet tigers, but
That's one of the theories that we had in France as well. Someone who had a pet tiger, illegal pet tiger, that got eaten or something, and the tiger, you know, escaped.
But yeah, we had one, and it was the same thing where the country was going crazy. People were creating Twitter accounts for Panjo, and they were saying free Panjo the tiger. Posters were created. It was quite an interesting news story. In the end, he was captured, and I think he was put in a reserve somewhere. But it was a very interesting news story.
Yeah, so tiger loose all around the world. There you go.
We've got coyotes all over the place here.
Oh, maybe we could.
You got bobcats down there too, don't you?
Up in the hills, there are bobcats too. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's a real, like, they can do damage. Not that, you know, a fox can't do damage, but usually we just ask what it says and it goes away. All right. Anyone else, or should we put this show, bring this show to a close? Right. I think that's going to be it. That was a fun episode, and serious as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on. Please tell the audience where they can find more of you guys on the internet, or, you know, somewhere else if you want to. Let's start with Tom.
Sure. TomMerritt.com. It's spelled with two R's and two T's. Actually, two M's, because it's all run together as one word. And that has all of the things that I do, the books I write, podcasts I do, and of course, Daily Tech News Show, DailyTechNewsShow.com, where Patrick is a contributor once a week.
Yeah, there you go. If you want your shows, your tech news on a daily dose, that's where you should go. Eric, how about yourself?
Yeah, the best way is to head over to China Africa Project, all one word, ChinaAfricaProject.com. That's the website. We're just launching a brand new newsletter, a weekly newsletter, with our blogs, our tweets, our podcasts, everything all that comes out once a week. But we also have a very, very dynamic Facebook page at Facebook.com/ChinaAfricaProject. Again, about 250,000 people, mostly from Africa and South Asia, but all over the world, kind of having a great conversation every day on what the Chinese are doing in Africa. And finally, we have a podcast, myself and Cobus van Staden from Wits University in Johannesburg. We get together twice a week and do a podcast on the latest issues, doing a lot like what we're doing here today. So look for us on iTunes. Just look for China Africa Project. And you can follow me on Twitter at EOLander, EOLANDER. And Patrick, just congratulations again for the show being back up, and really just humbled and honored to be here today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm honestly so happy that I could bring the show back. So, yeah, I'm really, really, really glad to be back on the air, which I'll tell a couple more words about in a second, after Paulo has had a chance to tell us if he's doing something on the internet or not.
Yeah, well, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Josie Paulo. And yeah, that's the best place to find what I'm up to these days. Yeah, that's the best place to...
Josie Paulo is
J-O-Z-I.
Ah, there you go.
P-A-U-L-O.
J-O-Z-I, Josie Paulo. There you go. All right. Thank you very much, Paulo. And as I was saying, I'm super excited to be back on the air. And it's really a show that I think is both something really strange and incredible, because it talks about important topics, and we have, like, even sometimes a little bit adversarial conversations. I mean, I didn't mention Turkey in the beginning. Turkey was a very prominent co-host of the show. He's not on the show yet. Maybe he's going to come back at some point, but he's very busy. But we'll see. Maybe we'll get him come back. But especially with him, we had lots of fun adversarial conversations, and I think we've been true to that heritage here today. And about super serious topics, but at the same time, we're keeping, you know, we're remaining friendly and we're staying friends, and we're having fun discussing these, sometimes not a huge amount of fun, but in the end, it's all in good humor and good conversation. And I think that's something that's missing from a lot of the media narrative that we're getting all around us. No one particularly at fault, but for this show, I think it works and it fits. That kind of thing should not exist, right? Should not be possible. Like, discussing these controversial topics with people from all of these different locations, but still remaining casual and fun, and it works here. So I'm super happy to be bringing back the show, because I think it's important and fun and, you know, informational. And so if you, dear listener, agree, and if you think that's an interesting show, I'd encourage, because now I'm a professional podcaster. My activity online is where I get my my revenue from. And so I launched a Patreon, which is a type of crowdfunding for the show. And if you think the show is worth staying on the air, I'd encourage you to go to the Patreon page and look at the video where I go over what I've been saying here, maybe in a little bit more detail, and consider giving a couple of bucks, whatever you think is appropriate, to the show, if you think it's worth it. There's a lot of people using Patreon nowadays to finance these kinds of shows, so it's probably not the first time you've heard of it, but it's something that works and that is a credible alternative to ad financing. And I think in this case, it completely makes sense to have a Patreon for the show. So anyway, you can find that at patreon.com/thephileasclub. And Phileas is Phileas, as the first name for Phileas Fogg. That's where the name came from. So please go and take a look at that if you think it's worth it. And you can also follow me on Twitter at NotPatrick. That's the name I've been using for a long time. And you can find this show and others at FrenchSpin.com, which is the website where I host the shows I produce. So you can go there and find the show notes and comment on the episode we've done today. And maybe you disagree completely with everything we've said. You can let us know that on that website. It's FrenchSpin.com. So again, thank you so much to my co-hosts for the show, for the first show of the relaunch. Thank you so much to you guys listening to this show, and we'll see you in about a month for the next episode. See you then. Bye, everyone.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.